Welcome to the Future of Teamwork podcast, where we explore cutting-edge strategies to keep teams human-centered, drive innovation, and empower you with the tools and insights needed to help your team excel and thrive in today's changing world. Your host is Dane Gruneveld, a seasoned expert with over 20 years of experience enhancing team dynamics and innovation. In today's episode of the Future of Teamwork, Dane's joined by Sonam Ladani, a strategy and operations leader with over a decade of experience across payments, technology, e-commerce, and fast-moving commercial goods. With an executive MBA from London Business School and a deep background in leading high-performing teams, Sonam has helped global organizations drive strategy, execution, and innovation, from optimizing operations at Unilever to driving revenue operations in the tech and AI space. In this conversation, we'll explore how growth mindset, trust, and no-blame leadership shaped her career, and how those same principles are now guiding the next wave of AI adoption. From the future of agentic AI to the human side of digital transformation, Sonam shares why the best leaders act as coaches, enablers, and storytellers for their teams. So, teamwork makes the dream work, and we're here to inspire your next collaborative breakthrough. Gather your team or put on your headphones, and let's dive in together.
Welcome to the Future of Teamwork. My name's Dane Gruneveld, and today I'm joined by Sonam Ladani. Sonam is the RevOps leader at Tonomus, and we've been having a great conversation pre-show around growth mindset and deployment of AI and, you know, what it is to be on a great team. So it's going to be fun diving in today. Welcome, Sonam.
Hi, I'm so happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
No, thanks for joining. So tell us a little bit more about you. How did you come to be doing all of this really cool work?
So it started out really interestingly enough. I am a chemical engineer by profession, right out of university, oil and gas tanked. So I pivoted into the most logical thing that people would always need, which was soap. And yes. I decided to move into fast moving consumer goods as my first job. So I began at Unilever, where I spent about 2.5 years within their procurement and supply chain, really getting hands-on into the ops world. After that, I moved on to Beiersdorf, which is the parent company that manufactures brands like Nivea, 8x4, Eucerin, a lot of those really well-known names that, you know, I felt a lot of trust toward. So I was really excited to go work on that. And I was there for about 4 years, where I led their sales and operations planning. During that time, I decided that my real passion was in tech, and I wanted to find a way to merge all the experience I gained in operations with all of the fancy new growth that I was seeing in the tech sector. So I decided to do an MBA. I went to London Business School, and over there, I moved into Amazon immediately after, where I spent about 7 months in their go-to-market team working on a turnaround project where we were really focusing on a struggling business unit and implementing strategies to drive revenue there. And that takes me to where I am today. I've been with Tonomus for the last 3 years, and right now I lead the revenue operations function here.
That's so neat. And working for some great platforms, it's fascinating that the oil and gas price tanking led you into that market, because I've spent a lot of my career in oil and gas and seen, you know, how critical chemical engineers are to that and other industries. But I was certainly living through that oil price crisis. It was deep. I think the price dropped from $140 a barrel to $25 in, you know, within 6 months. And we were all scratching our heads and wondering what we were going to do. So it was pretty rough times. But you've landed well. And I've always been fascinated by the big FMCG brands, because they do produce, you know, world-class talent. I've seen so much good talent out there. And I've heard really interesting stories of how they run teams. So, you know, if you look back on that early stage of your career, what was it that shaped your beliefs and philosophy around good teamwork and growth mindset from those times?
Well, that's a great question. Honestly, in those first few roles, I was exposed to a lot of pressure at a very early stage in my career. And we realized as a whole that there was no way we were going to meet these timelines and these sort of deliverables if we went in on our own. The only way through was together. And I think that was just such a wonderful lesson to have ingrained in me at the earliest stage of my career. So as I got more mature throughout my role, we started adopting a very strong growth mindset approach. And this really came through with my previous manager at Beiersdorf. He was incredibly supportive when it came to pushing his team to grow and develop themselves, try new tools. You know, if there's a problem in the team, let's see what you can do to fix it. And he had a very nice coaching approach, which shaped me in a beautiful way, because I find that now whenever I face a problem, the first instinct isn't to go and ask for help, but rather to go and look internally and see what tools do I have that I can try first? What are the tools that I have that I've not thought about using yet?
I really like that. And I've seen more recently a big shift towards the leader's role as a coach. There's a lot that we write about in the various articles these days on, you know, it's no longer a leader's role to have the information, to be that fountain of knowledge or truth. It's really to coordinate the best of the team and the resources that the team have. And it's fascinating also that you touched on that, the pressure factor, because pressure can be very difficult for teams and for individuals. But if you've got a coach who, or a leader who's coaching, I can imagine that you're able to channel that pressure towards productive outcomes rather than destructive outcomes.
Absolutely. I remember this one time that someone on my team had complained that this one task she was doing was taking about 6 or 7 hours. And this was something that I needed to deal with because this was one of my indirect reports. And I realized very quickly that I could do one of two things, right? I could say, this is your job. You have to do it. I don't care if it takes 6 hours. Or I could take the feedback that genuinely something is broken here. We can say status quo is as is, or I can try and do something about it. So I went on Excel, taught myself how to code a macro, and coded a VBA macro that would automate this work for her. So now, 6 hours, she could click a button and it would just happen in the background in 20 minutes. Now I had 6 people on the team doing this. So the amount of time that was saved scaled up across 6 people. And this sort of scaling is the same thing that we're seeing right now with AI, where you brought in a new tool and suddenly you have the ability to optimize and find efficiencies that just didn't exist before.
That's fascinating. And I love that as a leader, you were able to jump in and spot the feedback and take the action. What did that produce for you with those reports at that time? You know, because sometimes people take safety from having lots of work to do. As much as they'll complain about it, all of a sudden you've got these people that have got these extra hours. You know, where did you take that next?
Honestly, the impact was incredible because people were spending less time generating reports and more time digging into the data that went into it. So rather than just getting a printout of numbers and demand forecasts, I was getting a really deep understanding of what these numbers meant. Why had they gone up and down? What does that mean in the future? And to take it up to senior management, what does that mean in terms of our risk profile? Are we going to meet our targets for the end of the year? Mm. And hey, because they had extra time, they were able to call up the distributor and find a bunch of different opportunities that they could use to plug the gaps in our forecast right now. So it was interesting. Such a strong return on that one investment. It took about 5 hours of my day, but it gave them back about 12 hours a month.
Yeah, that's huge. It's really interesting where they spent their time that they recovered. I love that you talk about understanding the data more or taking different actions to improve the longer range forecast. Was that something that you led them to, or is that something that the team, once they have time, they're going to more naturally gravitate towards and find?
Ideally, that's something that should have been happening, but because they were spending so much time building mundane reports, they just didn't have the time to, right? Because they had to submit a report by a certain deadline. And unfortunately, the deadline is not going to change, but what's going to change is the output and the quality you get from it. So we got the same deadline, but just the quality went up by so much more.
That's neat. That's really neat. I can imagine most team members right now who are sitting there doing the more mundane tasks would A, enjoy a little bit more of value-adding work, but B, they'd kind of know where to go do it if they were asked. So it's a great reminder to leaders out there to be thinking about not just saving costs or reducing friction from an innovation or business process, but you know, how does that allow you to activate your employees to give more of their best?
Absolutely. There's always small wins around there. And, you know, if I didn't have that message of growth mindset instilled in me at such an early point, it probably wouldn't even have occurred to me to have tried that with my team. And I'm just really happy and honored that, you know, my indirect reports were enough to tell me this and give me this feedback in a way that I could do something about it. Because you do see a lot of the times where teams that aren't in a psychologically safe environment don't even feel safe or comfortable enough to come to you with that information. So I think
they don't want to be the squeaky wheel.
Exactly. And for me, just getting that demand signal from their side was so telling.
No, I love that. You also shared pre-show, we were talking about your time at Beiersdorf, great leader there. And you said there was a culture of no blame. So could you expand upon, you know, how that took shape and what it meant for you and the team?
So honestly, that was probably one of my best takeaways from my time at that company, where all they cared about was the end result. There was very little of whose fault is it that we didn't get there. Yes, there were postmortems where we spoke about these are the things that went wrong. This is how we're going to address it in the future. But at no point do we ever point a finger at anyone saying, you did this. This is why this didn't happen. And what that did was create this sort of space where it was okay to take risks. It was okay to try something different because it meant that your upside was recognized and celebrated. And for your downside, you know, you had someone who had your back, who would make sure that you were not directly under fire. Your work was fixed. You know, we held you accountable in private, but in public, you wouldn't be that person attaching an email and forwarding it to senior management saying so-and-so did, and this is why we're in this situation. It was very much a, there's a problem. What can we do to fix it right now?
Yes. So did that create more of an all hands when there was a problem? Did the team come in to, I guess, celebrate the identification of the problem and then start solutioning?
Absolutely. And a large part of it helped because the KPIs of everyone on the team across the company were actually unified to 50%.
Right.
So on a certain level, we were all steering the boat in the same direction. We all knew our number one priority was the same thing because it impacted all of us. And the second 50% was very much performance and function-based. But that first 50% was purely company performance and very specific company metrics at that.
I love that. I had a guest on the show, Eric Coriel, and he talks about accountable teams. And there's five factors of an accountable team, but two of them I think you've shared there. One of them is having a common scoreboard. Like we all need to be working towards the same score in whatever game we're playing, because if we're all, you know, playing different games, it's very confusing. So it sounds like that 50% KPI did that. The other one was a shared fate, which I think the bonuses and the conversations are very focused on in this setting that you share, which is, hey, we're going to try things. We're going to take risks. We're going to look to lift as a team. And that means every now and again, something will break. And, you know, we own that together. We'll solve it. So I think that's really fascinating.
Thank you. It was honestly a wonderful experience working there.
Oh, that's brilliant. My final question on that point in time, it really comes back to cross-functional work. So a lot of the data right now suggests that intact teams, so let's say a buying procurement team or an accounting finance team, are increasing their levels of engagement within the intact team because they're working well together. They're choosing their own tools. They're working in a way that lifts each other up. However, across functions, if you then take the procurement function and the finance function, there's tensions because they're operating on different rhythms, schedules, you know, objectives. What did you see differently in that period of time where there was that no blame culture and shared fate when it came to cross-functional work compared to, say, some of the other organizations you'd been a part of?
I think in Beiersdorf, they did a really great job of exemplifying good leadership. So even the GM of the region at the time used to host frequent town halls, but beyond that, he had a lot of touch points within all the different functions. So everyone had so much face time with the GM. He knew us by name. He knew what we were doing. So much so that when he knew on pieces we were working on, he would say, oh, hey, in finance, they're working on something that's incredibly similar. You guys should link up. So the level of sponsorship that cross-functional collaboration got wasn't just something you'd saw as a value on a wall. It was exemplified by leadership and embodied so thoroughly that cross-functional working was just embedded as a way of work.
That's super neat. I love that storyteller role then of a leader. That's what I'm hearing, Sonam, which is, hey, if the leader is spending time with people and they're in the work to the appropriate degree, then when they walk into a new problem or a new team, they can point you in that direction or say, hey, it was awesome that I saw these guys working on that last month. Maybe you guys can go and check in on how that could help you.
A strong leader plays the role of an enabler, right? It goes back to what you said earlier. We don't expect your leaders to have the answers, but you do expect them to give you the resources to find the answer.
Yeah, that's great. I think that's one thing that all leaders can do. And it's something that I've personally found is energizing, because it's easy to get stuck in whatever the big problem is to solve in the business, but actually just getting out and walking the floor. And it's not managing by walking around. It's actually just like engaging with your people and getting curious and, you know, showing them that they matter as well. I think that's really powerful. So that brings you on to this more recent shift into deploying AI. And I heard in your intro, you said you realized this passion for tech. I was listening to a podcast the other day with Susie Welsh, and she was talking about passion being the intersection. She kind of described it as a Venn diagram. And if I remembered it right, she said, there's your capabilities, there's your virtues, and then there's the economic benefit of that work. So what was it, if you think about, you know, your capabilities and what you find to be important in life at large, what was it that kind of drew you into tech and specifically AI?
That's such a good question. For me, I've always valued being able to make an impact and make a difference at a place where I genuinely want to use the product. And it's very specific and niche, but to me, if I don't want to use the product that I'm selling, how am I supposed to be part of it in a way that's genuine and authentic? So I realized more and more as I was going through my career that I was the one looking up new tools to build. I was the one that was saying, guys, let's build a dashboard that does this or that. Let's use, a VBA thing that does this. I found this fancy AI thing, which wasn't really a thing back then. And I just realized that that's where I was getting my energy from. And my manager at the time also recognized that. And he started pushing me a lot more toward the digitization projects and things like that, because he noticed that that's really where I was shining. So after a while, I sort of had to acknowledge that I was enjoying the side part of my job, which are these projects focused on tech, upskilling, building these extra capabilities in the organization, deploying the dashboards, than I was the main core function, which was the operations and supply chain. And so at that point, I have to admit, this is not necessarily the right industry for me, even though I've gained a lot from it.
Yeah. It's brilliant. I love that you touched on energy, because I do think that energy is a fantastic indicator and signal of where we do our best work as individuals and in teams. So it's cool that you were starting to find that energy by finding new tools and ways of working. And what sounds phenomenal. Sorry.
I don't know if people talk about energy, because I do think that there's two types of energy, right? There's energy as in I will wake up in the morning and go to the gym. But is that the highest quality of energy, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's really where I find the most meaning. Yes, I can give anything energy, but at what point do I feel like I am giving it energy and I'm getting something back out of it.
It goes both ways.
Exactly. That's the only time I feel the quality of energy is what matters, right? Because giving time isn't that hard. It's also giving the right type of time.
That's brilliant. Andre Martin, who I've done a fair bit of work with on this space, he talks about energy and time as both being finite. So it's critical that we manage them. And I love the way that you've just framed that. And I'll make sure Alicia makes a point on that in the show notes, is that if it's something that you give energy and you get it back, then it's sustainable. It's something that's going to keep self-generating and replicating rather than those draining activities that so many of us can find at work.
And that only comes from passion. You can't replicate it. Yeah. You can't fake it. You know, you can give it as much time as you want, but without passion, it's just not going to come.
That's neat. I really like that. And then naturally you had a boss who was willing to kind of identify that and support you in chasing some of those projects, the digitalization and otherwise. So I think that's also really important. I also had a boss at an earlier stage in my career that said, hey, my job here is to help you go to where you're going. And while you're here, I'm going to benefit from your work, but it doesn't mean you always have to be here. And I thought it was fascinating the way he presented that. It was kind of counterintuitive to me at first.
And the best thing is that after I left that company and, you know, I'm scaling my own teams now, I'm growing my teams, I'm building in the tools and the creating the processes to create that atmosphere for my own team, that mindset very much stuck with me. And I love the fact that I've been able to scale teams now and create my own functions, keeping that as the core of my ethos.
Oh, I love that. That's awesome. So that actually leads really well into this concept of soft skills in AI deployments that you touched on pre-show. Because obviously leadership is important. How we connect as humans is important. How we identify our unique strengths and skills is important. And then there's the technology, which can be dropped in. I think the MIT study that recently said 95% of generative AI pilots are failing. That seems like it's a technical problem that is being solved without giving thought to the social processes of the business. So tell me a little bit more about what you're seeing there from your experiences.
I think the MIT study very much hit the nail on the head. What we're seeing with AI is that people do have a desire to do AI and embed AI into their processes. This is generally coming from top down. What we're seeing is that people, when they're going for it, haven't actually thought their AI and digital strategy through. Most enterprises lack a strategic roadmap saying, these are the use cases that we actually want to hit. And this is the type of impact that we want to have. Instead, you're seeing people say, let's put in a Gen AI chatbot somewhere. Let's have something write our emails. And when you go with really vague, bottom of the barrel, generic approach, that's the type of outcomes you're going to get. The ROI you get from, say, from writing an email is negligible at that point.
Yeah.
What is the actual effort that goes into writing an email? You save 2 or 3 minutes. Is this worth the millions in investment that you put into it? Probably not. And that's why people aren't seeing the impact that they're hoping to. It's because the cases they're choosing aren't important enough. They're so common baseline, general denominator that it gets diluted across the org without any meaningful upside. So the way to really unlock it on that social aspect is by being very specific about what it is you want AI to do for you, how long do you want it to take, and who's going to be doing it.
And then once you identify what do you want to do and you start to look at who's going to be doing it, what do you see as best practices for engaging those people and getting feedback from, you know, not from the top, but from the fringes of the organization where the real work's happening?
That's a really interesting question. To me, it starts with involving people from the very beginning. So the way I think about it is that the lack of AI adoption at large scale in enterprises is a trust problem. And trust is something that has technically been crafted out as an equation, right? The trust formula is credibility, reliability, intimacy, all overlaid on top of self-orientation, right? So if you're able to embed AI into your workflow in a way that satisfies all four of these, that's how you know you're doing something that's going to have the adoption to stick. Because right now, culture is the biggest barrier to AI adoption. It's not budget. It's not skill set. It's not technical prowess. It's purely culture. And that's a
solution. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. When you think about cultures, so much of it comes down to mythologies in a business, how things get done, what happens if you do it this way or that way. So those things are very... they're very tangible in an organization. Everyone tells stories about them. And so it's really hard when AI is coming into an organization and looking at a business process in a vacuum without knowing the stories of people who interact with those business processes. So I love that you bring in those four questions. Just to repeat them, you said credibility, reliability, intimacy, and then self-orientation. I think I've got a pretty good read on credibility and reliability, but I'd love to know how the intimacy and the self-orientation play out in that discovery process.
Oh, it's so interesting. So one thing you need to remember about AI is that great minds think alike, but fools seldom differ. AI is an echo chamber. Yep. It just amplifies what people and your data are already telling you. If your data quality itself is bad, your output is going to be even worse.
Yes.
And that's really where intimacy comes in, because you want to know that the tool you're working with is something that you can trust to share, listen, and provide that sort of analytical feedback.
Yes.
And that's the power of AI if done properly. If you are choosing the right use case and you've given it the right tooling and the correct context and knowledge bank, it should be able to self-adjust and self-correct and provide that sort of context saying that, okay, given this information, I can critically evaluate this and this is the path we're going to take. That's why agentic AI has seen such an uptick lately, because it does really satisfy that intimacy factor if the use case is powerful enough.
Interesting. So I haven't really played with agentic AI yet. I've read a little bit about it. How would you describe that to someone like me who hasn't really had that lived experience?
So agentic AI is actually very fascinating right now. It's an area with a ton of growth. Essentially, what it does is it connects a bunch of different apps together. So right now, if you think about it, let's take ChatGPT as an example because it's the most accessible. ChatGPT can only operate within the confines of the window. Agentic AI says, let's pretend there is no window. Let's pretend that I want to go on a holiday. An agentic AI approach will research the dates. It will look up, it'll go through your email so that it can email them on your behalf. It will look at your calendar and tell you these are the best dates. And hey, I've cross-referenced it with reviews from, trip.com. And I know that these hotels have promotions on these dates if you go here. Oh, by the way, I've looked up on this booking coupon generator. You can get half off if you do this in this order.
Interesting.
Give an itinerary and here's your plane tickets.
So it really maps out the full flow of work rather than just being here's something you can plug into your work.
Exactly. Agentic AI has the ability to function outside of its immediate context.
Brilliant. So when we think about AI as a team member or technology as a team member, the agentic approach seems to feel like it could actually do a range of tasks across a range of mediums, more like humans do in their work.
To a certain extent, yes. It's successful in some cases, and in some parts, the technology isn't quite there yet. There's a lot of success in use cases involving travel, for example, a lot in marketing, in software engineering. So items where, I wouldn't say algorithmic, but in a case where there's enough data backing how it's been done in the past that an agent can learn from it.
Got it. That's very cool. So when you're going into those environments, the existence of data and different tool sets that the AI can access is really important. Where do I read all the time this concept of you should treat the AI as a intern. So, you know, it does 80% of the work and then the human needs to come in. Where do you find as you go into deploying AI in the right way that they construct new ways of work to do the review or the iterative work that's required to make sure that the AI continues to better learn the customers to process the objective?
What I've seen is that the teams that have had the most success in deploying AI, they use it for a certain part of it, but exactly like you said, they do understand that AI is almost like an intern. So going back to that trust equation, AI hasn't quite mastered credibility. Credibility means that I know that what comes out of here is 100% accurate, that if I ask you a question on teamwork, I know I'll get a valid answer. AI hasn't quite cracked that yet.
Yeah.
So I do think it has a way to go on credibility. And if you're treating it like an intern, you know, with a standard intern, you probably should cross-check their work. You know, no matter how long they've been, if they're an intern, you are still accountable for the output because it is going out of your inbox. So to a certain point, I think that's going to be there for at least a few more years. Because even now, when we do have agents, we still have one manager overseeing 5 agents. It is never...
Interesting.
At least in the current practice, I think it's too soon to say never. But... Yeah. In current practice, agents are not independent enough to not have a human around just for a cross check. A lot of them will get it right all the time, which is great. But you still should have a human touch point there just to be sense checked.
So that's a pretty cool visual, a manager with 5 agents working for it.
Yeah, it's actually much more common than you think. On a lot of career pages, you see people actually hiring agents where they would be hiring full-time people. And the reason that agents is for developers to say, hey, if you're developing an agent that does this, apply it, send
I'll
it
hire it.
We will hire your agent.
So you can. So that, do you think that we're going to see a kind of like an expansive period where people are designing agents that are very specific in their tasks? So kind of like when we saw apps take off in the early iPhone era, is it going to go way out before it comes back in?
I do think so. And now making agents is even easier than it was before. You could spend an hour and a half and make your own agent without any coding, any developer background whatsoever. And it's become much more accessible than a lot of the tools were before. When we had the cloud era a decade ago, it wasn't that accessible to the common man. You knew you needed to be on the cloud, but beyond that, you didn't know how to. Same with metaverse, right? It was cool. Most people didn't actually know how to interact with the metaverse. This is a bit different than that, where it's incredibly accessible. You can go on right after this call and make your own agent that's going to spin up guests for you, do the background research, and give you a list of questions for the rest of the year if you wanted to.
Fascinating. That's really fascinating. And you could see that in teams, I would imagine. So if I had a, let's say I had an executive coach on one of my teams and they wanted to build an agent that could help find them executives to extend coaching to, and then they wanted to build another agent that could do all of the scheduling because executives are always hard to schedule, then they could almost go and build those 2 agents and extend their team without having to hire anyone.
Very easily. And a lot of these templates already exist. You're not recreating the wheel here. These are templates that are there. They're online. They're reviewed. Just go click download.
Yeah, that's fascinating. No, I haven't really spent that much time in there. I'm intrigued now that you've prompted me to go and take a look. Where are the dangers when someone comes in? You know, how do you avoid creating chaos, you know, bad customer experience or upsetting a team member that you've traditionally relied on for some of that support? Like, are there any tips or tricks that you lean into there?
I mean, that's a very good question. And what I've realized is that the smart teams here are using it to augment their work, not replace.
Yes. Yeah.
Right. We've seen and read a bunch of case studies where CEOs have gotten a bit too ambitious and they have entirely cut teams only to rehire them a few months down the road. So that's probably not the best way to go about it, right? we're at a point where we want to free you up from the mundane tasks that take up a bunch of your time so you can really focus on things that are value added to you and your team. Kind of like that example I gave about VBA back in the day is essentially how we should be thinking about AI today. If you're not using it to support yourself, you're going to get replaced by someone who is. So that's the way I look at it, rather than don't worry that AI is going to replace you. Worry that someone using AI better than you will.
Well, so that raises a really interesting question, which is, and you mentioned earlier about a lot of AI deployments being top down. Are you seeing any customers now? Once upon a time, you know, maybe a company gave professionals a professional development stipend every year. Here's $2,000. Go and do your continuing professional education or go to a conference or a course so that you can learn. Do you see a shift to where people are going to have their like agentic AI stipends and it's just like go and play, go and build something that may augment your work and report back on how that's working for you so that we can extend best practices?
You know, I've not seen that, but that's actually a great idea. I might steal that.
Go steal away. I'm and once you get the playbook, let me know.
That's a great idea. But it would be a really good shout.
Yeah, it would be interesting to see because it's easy for me to come in and say, hey, I think Andrew needs a coach scheduling agent. But Andrew might see something very different. He might be sitting there going, you know what I really need is something to help me with building thought leadership in this space. Or I need a tool that helps me collect data more easily, you know, in the build up to a coaching call from my customer's work environment so that we've got some tangible facts to be jumping into. So he might see it totally different to me.
I mean, that's very interesting. The one call out I would sort of say on that is just be careful that everyone's not doing a bunch of small things because that's how silos form. So if everyone has their own stipend, all building their own agents, how do you know that you're not just repeating each other?
Great point. You know? Maybe there's some kind of committee or charter, which is like, hey, here's your stipend. Please submit your design criteria and then we'll help give you the go ahead on, yes, you can do it. We don't want to create a bottleneck, but at least we can say, oh, hey, Sonam, it looks like you're doing this, but you know, Jenny just did something like that 6 weeks ago. So go talk to her first.
Exactly. And it really does come back to organizations that have a strong digital strategy and a roadmap tend to be a lot more successful about this because they're giving it that long-term thought rather than just short-term gains.
Yeah, that I think that's a good point too. Yeah, it's always hard with any change. You get excited by the immediacy of the impact, but then you don't think about the second order or third order flow down effects. So having someone taking that longer term view is important. You know, for example, that might save your day 3 hours of time, but have you just created chaos in your customer's environment because now they're having to deal with an agent? I don't know.
Or is 3 hours of your time worth less than the price of running the agent because you're doing API call and these things are expensive. So
yes.
Is it actually just more economical for you to spend the 3 hours on this?
Yeah, that's a good point. We used to do an economic value assessment of different undertakings in our business. So maybe some kind of tool there that helps you kind of weigh up your time and the benefits is valuable. That's really cool. I guess a final question on that kind of stream of consciousness is you've just recently, I think, built your first AI agent. I saw a post from you on LinkedIn the other day. Can people do it for themselves or like the earlier example you provided, do you need to go out and sort of advertise that you're looking for an agent or have someone in your tech department, IT department kind of go out there and do the actual sourcing and building for you?
So I have no background in development, anything whatsoever. Yes, I'm an engineer. I do know how to code. However, full disclosure, I did a completely no code approach. It took about an hour and a half. I did it on a live webinar, which is hosted by 9X, where it was, I think, a group of 200 people. and they just walked us through how to make one. So if you are interested, I would say tune in to their webinars, because they do these live demos every week and a half where they pick a different tool and they sort of walk you through how to use it, what are the new features. And if you're someone like me that just really loves playing with technology, it's just, it's like a day in the playground.
Oh, that's so neat. That's so neat. All right. Well, that's a great takeaway as well. It's been a wonderful conversation, Sonam. It's from some of those early stories you shared about the value of pressure, you know, in the FMCG game, for informing you that it takes a team to work together through, you know, the hard objectives. I loved your stories of having great leaders there that, you know, moved away from blame and coached you and supported new tooling and particularly helping you find that energy. I really like the way you described energy as kind of bi-directional. Am I getting energy back from the energy that I give? It's a great signal. I thought the topic around leaders having to exemplify the role of leadership in going around and telling stories and connecting people is super powerful. And then as we got onto this AI conversation, it definitely resonates around the trust and those, you know, that formula of trust, the importance of the strategic roadmap and taking a longer term view. I think that stands out really well. And again, augmenting work, not replacing work. I think it allows us to continue to index for the human element of work at the same time as the machines coming. So I particularly enjoy that view. So thank you for sharing all of those points.
And of course, and thank you so much for having me. It's been such a fun conversation.
You bet. If any of our listeners want to reach out and connect with you, learn more about what you're doing or your latest thinking and research in this space, how do they do that?
Well, LinkedIn is great. I'm very active. I try and get back to people within a day or two. So please reach out to me there.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much for your time, Sonam. It's been really fun.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Just a quick note before we go. The views and opinions shared in this episode are those of our guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the host, Dane Gruneveld, the Leader Group, our patron Huddle 3, or our partners and affiliates. Any scenarios discussed are for the purpose of fueling creative thinking and conversation and should be viewed only in this context. Dane, Leader, our sponsors, partners, and affiliates do not endorse any guest or any organization they may be associated with. It's important to remember that every workplace is as individual as the people within it. Our recommendation is to always seek solutions that are specifically designed to help serve your team's unique needs. And to this point, please know we're here, ready to help you find the best way forward, no matter where your starting point is. You can connect with Dane or myself, Alicia McCraw, on LinkedIn or via the links contained in the show notes. Thanks again for tuning in. And hey, if you think someone in your network would benefit from this episode, feel free to share it or give us a 5-star rating. Those 5 little stars really help us reach more curious people like you. We'll catch you next time on the Future of Teamwork.